Andrew Hastie, welcome to the podcast.
It's good to chat with you, Tom.
Thank you for making some time. You were at the National Security College here in Canberra this week. A really interesting speech. You say that Australia is seeing a geopolitical rupture, an economic rupture, and an intellectual one as well. There's no hot war in Iran, but you say that the operation led by the US and Israel has transitioned into the Battle of Hormuz. Did Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu underestimate the challenge they're faced in the region?
I didn't see the intelligence, obviously, but I do think that President Trump was overconfident, and he's had success with Operation Midnight Hammer last year. He had success with Venezuela, and I think the expectation was this would be a short war, but the enemy always has a vote, and Iran is using the geography at the Strait of Hormuz to their advantage, and they're using it to apply immense pressure to American allies who depend upon the importation of hydrocarbons out of the Middle East. So we're feeling that because we import about 90% of our liquid fuel, a lot of it from Asia. But if you trace the supply chain, a lot of it originates in the Middle East, up to 60%. So we are feeling the squeeze. We're feeling the squeeze at the Bowser, and we're also seeing shortages emerge across the economy.
Should the US have thought more about the international ramifications, do you think we can rely on the US as a trusted ally still?
Well, I said today that the post-Cold War rules-based order is dead, and in the cemetery alongside it is buried the peace dividend, which was the basis of our trade and our prosperity. And, you know, I mentioned Iran, I mentioned Russia and China as authoritarian powers who are flexing their muscles. But the US itself, in their latest national security document, has said that the rules-based order was a cloud castle abstraction. So when the very country that's meant to be underwriting the rules-based order says that it's dead, we've got to take that seriously. And that's why my call today was about reindustrialization, which gives us more control and more resilience, control over our own future as a country. You need a level of hard power, and it also gives us resilience so that in the event of a crisis, we can pivot as a country. We have that complexity and depth and adaptability in our economy so that we can make up for shortfalls.
On the question of reindustrializing, you said that Australia had outsourced some of our military obligations, our capabilities to the US and our industrial capability to the region around us, and that that was unwise. Imagine you're the Prime Minister tomorrow. What's the first step on reindustrialisation? Where should we start?
I think it's energy. I think decarbonisation has led to deindustrialisation, and now we're building a dependency into our power grid. A lot of people don't like to hear this, but this is the truth of the matter. The vast majority of solar, wind and batteries are made in China. Using fossil fuels, a lot of our coal and gas goes to China, obviously. A lot of our critical minerals go to China. And I'd much prefer to not be dependent upon the importation of solar, wind and batteries for our future energy grid. The president of the European Commission yesterday in Parliament warned us about dependency on another country. In her case, she mentioned Europe's dependency on Russia, and I fear we're doing the same thing here. So for your listeners, the thing I care about most is this amazing democracy that we have in this country. I know a lot of your listeners won't agree with me, but I want to preserve a democracy that is sovereign so that we can have these debates and work out how to live better together. That's why I'm a Liberal, because I believe that we leave our ultimate convictions at the door when we come to politics and we work out how we live peaceably with our neighbours.
The fuel disruptions, I think the kind of top line from your comments was that they should have been better anticipated. And this goes to Ursula von der Leyen yesterday. Australia's quite vulnerable, big island nation at the bottom of the world. The challenge, though, might be that the political rhetoric on fuel disruption and shortages is making the problem worse. Do you think it's possible that your side of politics could be part of the problem here?
Look, I think both sides of politics have been asleep at the wheel over the last 40 years, and I've said that. You know, the deindustrialisation that occurred over the last 40 years, that was a bipartisan project. It started with Hawke, Keating, continued under Howard, and then it sort of accelerated, you know, from the Rudd, Gillard, Rudd, Abbott years. And it was the Abbott government that turned off the lights at, or decided to turn off the lights with our car manufacturing. So look, there's a, you know, there's a narrative there, but we've got to be future focused. And what are we doing about things today? Well, our job is to hold the government to account and make sure that where there are shortages in the economy, that people are not hoarding, and that we're smoothing out the distribution of fuel. And we also want the government to do a good job here. There's a lot at stake here. So we're doing our job as an opposition, but we've also got to start talking about the future and what comes next. And I think if this continues, and, you know, the most optimistic assessments about the Battle of Hormuz is that it, you know, it won't be finished until the end of April, best case scenario. This could go on for some time. And if that's the case, well, then it's time to have a discussion about what sovereignty looks like in a in an energy context.
Yep. To that end, the International Energy Agency boss, Fatih Birol, was at the press club this week. I thought it was an interesting question and answer session. I thought his message for Australia was quite interesting. He said that energy security is best achieved by a faster transition to renewables, more electric vehicles, more batteries, noting that they are the lower cost option. He said that could be the solution that Australia should be building up for the next crisis. Tell me your thoughts.
Well, we're on a massive continent. We have about 26 million people here, and we have the challenge of geography, which is why we've gone for diesel for the vast majority of our logistics and transport. All our Coles, Woolies, trucks run on diesel. We have flights that are longer than European flights. This was a point made yesterday by the President of the European Commission. And so for the foreseeable future, we're going to need petrol, we're going to need diesel, and we're going to need aviation fuel. I'm not opposed to electrification. I just don't want distortions in the energy market. And I think we shouldn't be subsidising one form of technology over another, especially when, you know, this pretense about it being greener is actually false. When you look at China's emissions, they're more than 30% of the world's global emissions. Where does most of the solar, wind and batteries get made? They get made in China using fossil fuels.
The counterpoint might also come from his answers yesterday. He said 5 years ago, only 5% of car transport was electric. 25% of cars now are electric around the world. And I think the figure was in the past 5 years, 85% of new power source has been renewable. Isn't the world moving in this direction? Why would we go in a different direction?
I mean, I go to the IEA website routinely and I look at the sources of energy for each country. And when you look at the uptake of renewables in the Asia-Pacific region, it's still a very small percentage. And what's driving a lot of the uptake of fossil fuels, gas, coal, and investment in nuclear power is the new technology race driven by AI. And an AI search, generative AI, is 10 times more intensive than a Google search. And so countries who are, you know, trying to get the edge in productivity economically, they're trying to invest strategically, they're saying that there's a huge energy cost for this investment. And that's why fossil fuels is still part of the mix and it's still delivering baseload power more cheaply than renewables. Now, over time, that might change. But again, I come back to the fact that we're in a very competitive space globally and I want the best for my country, just like every other country.
Yeah, yeah. Let me ask you a kind of fundamental question about your political positions and how you see the world. I think some of our listeners and some of the readers of The Guardian will have really resonated with your comments about Donald Trump and about some of the forces that are at play in politics here and around the world, but then perhaps have a completely different perspective to you on something like renewables and climate change. How should we describe you? How should we understand your political philosophy?
I'm a liberal. And I believe very much in, you know, those basic democratic freedoms, freedom of conscience, freedom of speech, freedom of association. And but I also believe in community and I believe in my country. And I guess I used to be a neocon and a neoliberal. And then I went over to Afghanistan and that worldview, which I'd inherited from time in university and through my reading, was absolutely shattered. And so I came back and to give your listeners a sense of who I read Edmund Burke and Roger Scruton. And I really respect the power of geography, the power of culture. And I also think government is limited and should be limited. And part of the reason why everything is so contested is that we've seen the state grow so much that a lot of questions which shouldn't be political have become political because the state is now involved in them. And I'd love to see a country where we step back a little bit from politics and, you know, we don't make every debate a zero-sum debate.
That's interesting. I mean, the system often puts us in camps and often goes zero-sum very quickly, doesn't it?
It does, and it's really frustrating. And, of course, this trend is being magnified by social media. And so one of the things I try to do is just listen to my opponents more. And, in fact, you know, I'll be honest with you, for a long time I avoided the ABC and The Guardian, but now I just feel this freedom to just tell you what I really think and have a good old chat. And I think I'm stimulated by the debate.
That's great. Well, we're glad you're keen to talk to us and talk to our listeners and readers. Okay, one of the flow-on effects of the current crisis is a question of the profits that some in the commodity sector are making, big price increases in just a few weeks. Shouldn't Australia consider a 25% profit on gas? There's a push here in Parliament and perhaps even Labor considering this at the moment.
Yeah, look, I think a lot of people, Australians, feel like the multinationals don't have a social licence, that they've had a really good run of our wealth here. And so I'm sympathetic to that point of view. I just know how important, you know, those industries are to Australia, so I'd want to get it right. So, yeah, I guess I'm open-minded about those questions. But, of course, I see this every day. I mean, you open up your social media and you hear all sorts of viewpoints, and this one is quite strong and quite pronounced.
You think that
across the left-right spectrum.
That people feel that the multinationals are taking the piss, really, that we're losing our strategic, the value from our commodities.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people think of Norway and their sovereign wealth fund, and they think, well, why can't we do something similar? And I think that's a really good point. I'd love to see an Australian sovereign wealth fund that, you know, sets us up for generations to come.
Would you make the case internally for the opposition to at least consider a gas tax in this current climate?
Well, I think I'm really keen to see a sovereign wealth fund.
Okay.
A sovereign wealth fund. How you do that, I'm open-minded about, but I think we need to start planning for the future. And across all, across the political spectrum, I think we need to have a conversation about balancing budgets. All across Australia, you have families who are having to balance budgets. So my point would be, if we're expecting Australian families to make their budgets work, why shouldn't the government, why shouldn't the Commonwealth government make the budget work? And I think that's something that isn't popular, but I think it's a conversation we need to have.
Just to make sure I understand, I mean, making the budget work, a lot of this revenue would be really helpful for our challenges. Is that what you mean?
Sure. Well, you know, it's got to be spent wisely.
Right.
And that's why a sovereign wealth fund would be a good vehicle to making sure that any revenue collected is, you know, put to good purposes rather than, you know, the whims of a government.
Yep. Yeah. Okay, I'm eager to come to your portfolio in the Angus Taylor opposition. You've got a big job. One of the great quotes from the speech at the National Security College, you say that the economy should be operating like a Swiss Army knife, but actually it resembles a butter knife currently. Where should we go on things like productivity and prosperity, economic growth? Have both parties failed on that question as well?
Well, I think the point I was making there is we dig a lot of stuff out of the ground and we send it overseas, and I'd love to see, you know, our value chains vertically integrated. We can value add. We can dig stuff up. We can refine it. We can process it. And then, you know, we could manufacture and make things out of it, but we don't do that very often. And that's why we keep tumbling down Harvard's index of economic complexity. We're 74th. Countries like Singapore, Japan, the US, they're all in the top 10. I think New Zealand is at 49th. And one of the things I really care about is real wage growth for Australians. And advanced manufacturing is one of the ways that you drive productivity, and productivity drives real wage growth. And a lot of Australians, you know, low to middle income earners, they've gone backwards with inflation. And when, you know, a country is more productive, it lifts everyone up, including low-skilled workers. And that was the point I was making today, which is why I'm so keen on advanced manufacturing. There's the whole sovereignty piece where, you know, in a crisis, you can quickly pivot, you know, if you have an advanced manufacturing capability. I know people think I'm just barracking for cars. I do like cars. But if you have a capability, you can pivot between sectors, from defence to space to medicine to agriculture. Whatever it is and wherever the need is, you can shift labour and capital and get things happening.
Labor talks about advanced manufacturing a lot, and the Future Made in Australia agenda is along these lines. They're also, at least they say, they're quite focused on lifting productivity as well. Are they getting anything right, do you think, in that space?
Well, the Future Made in Australia policy, when you actually study the national interest framework, you know, there's two streams. There's the net zero decarbonisation stream, and then there's the, you know, critical resources stream, the economic resilience stream. And my concern is that we're just going to be funding projects that takes a lot of our industry offshore anyway. In the national interest framework document that Treasury put out back in 2024, it talks about, you know, the dominance that China has in manufacturing solar and wind. Mm. And then that's a real opportunity for us. Now, that sounds like we're going to support industry overseas, not industry here.
And Treasury expressed some reservations about making solar panels here.
Yeah. I mean, I'd love to make solar panels here. I'd love to make wind turbines here. But unfortunately, they're being made overseas. So for your listeners to understand what I care about, I want to thicken our economy. I want to keep capital and jobs here, and I want to be resilient in a crisis. I mean, that's my starting point. And from there, I'm pretty pragmatic about how we do that. I just don't think we should be distorting markets by picking winners. I think we just get energy costs down, we become cost competitive a nation, and then we start providing incentives for investment here, and let's see what happens.
Do you anticipate a policy in your portfolio for voters at the next election that lays some of these plans out?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm you know, really, really keen to build a vision for reindustrializing Australia. I think low energy costs is the first thing. I think advanced robotics and AI isn't a huge threat the way people make it out to be. Hmm. There's two forms of labour that AI is going to disrupt. There's cognitive labour and there's physical labour. I think one of the reasons why a lot of multinationals have gone offshore is because they've wanted to exploit cheap labour overseas in countries that, you know, have poor laws governing their labour. And I think the opportunity that AI and advanced robotics presents is that we can recover our supply chains back to Australia. And we can create jobs. Now, they may not look like the jobs of the past, but I think we can actually recover a lot of the lost work that has gone overseas.
Yeah, you don't have to pay a robot in an advanced manufacturing setting, but you do have to employ engineers, scientists, technologists who can build it and operate it.
Exactly. And you know, the mechanics who work on the robots. You know, my wife's from a she's American, but she's from a General Motors family. You know, she grew up in a union town. And I've seen how important those jobs are to a community. And I think, yeah, if we actually, you know, get the cost of production down here, we can create a whole bunch of jobs and thicken our communities again.
Some of these questions and the concerns that relate to them, economic situations, household budgets, employment prospects, are the factors that I think are fueling some of the new forces in Australian politics. I think One Nation is an example of that. People who feel that the system isn't working for them, they feel like they've lived up to their end of the bargain. One Nation's having a big week, obviously, after the South Australian results. Tell me your thoughts on where Pauline Hanson fits into our politics. And I'm interested, do you think that the Liberals and Nationals are in part to blame for the rise of One Nation?
It's a really good question. I think there's a lot of unhappiness about the system. And if we break down what they mean by the system, housing's a big issue. A lot of people feel like they just can't get into the housing market now. And if we go all the way back to 2009 and you track the supply of M1 money, it's gone up about 300%. And there was a massive credit boom, a cheap credit boom, in fact, from about 2010 to 2022. Hmm. And if you were able to get a loan, buy a house then, you did well. But once interest rates started going up in May of or April 2022, it's a lot harder now. And you've got to remember real wages didn't track with inflation either. And so a lot of people just feel locked out of the housing market. The system's rigged against them. They blame the political system and the institutions like the RBA. I think the pandemic broke a lot of social license really badly. I mean, I remember standing on the polling booth in 2022 and there were Alcoa workers who'd been sacked because they didn't want the vaccine.
Wow, yeah.
And I just remember one guy, he was literally shaking with rage when he was telling me. And I thought, okay.
Something's happening.
Something's happening here. So there's that and there's immigration. Any way you look at it, numbers have gone up. We've got our lowest fertility rate ever in Australian history, 1.4 births per woman. And if you look at the average net overseas migration figure from 2000 to 2019, it was about 190,000. And over the last 3-4 years, we've had 1.3 million people added to our country. That's net overseas migration. That's not permanent migration. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's that issue as well. And the politics on that have bolted.
Yeah.
And so that's, so Pauline Hanson is giving voice to those concerns and frustrations.
Tom McElroy and Andrew Hastie will be